Friends, I'm going to ask you to turn your Bibles to Ruth chapter 4 as we conclude what I trust for you is also being a very encouraging series in a very small but wonderful book in the Bible. Ruth chapter 4, as we consider today, resolution at the city gate, resolution at the city gate. The account continues, beginning in verse 1, as follows. Now Boaz went up to the gates and sat down there, and behold, the kinsman redeemer of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, "Turn aside, my fellow, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. Then he took 10 of the men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the fields of Moab, has to sell a portion of the field which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to uncover this matter in your hearing, saying, acquire it before those who are sitting here, and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if no one redeems it, tell me, that I may know. For there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "On the day you acquire the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the one who had died, in order to raise up the name of the one who had died on behalf of his inheritance." So the kinsman redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the right of redemption and the exchange of land to establish any matter. A man removed his sandal and gave it to another. And this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, "Acquire this for yourself." And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, "You are witnesses today that I have acquired all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon from the hand of Naomi. And also I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the one who had died on behalf of his inheritance, so that the name of the one who had died will not be cut off from his brothers or from the gates of his birthplace. You are witnesses today." And all the people were in the gate, and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May Yahweh grant the woman who is coming into your home to be like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built up the house of Israel. And so you shall achieve excellence in Ephrathah and shall proclaim your name in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the seed which Yahweh will grant you by this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and Yahweh granted her conception, and she gave birth to a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed is Yahweh who has not left you without a kinsman redeemer today. May his name be proclaimed in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of your soul and a sustainer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and put him on her bosom and became his nurse. The neighbor woman gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez became the father of Hezron, and Hezron became the father of Ram, and Ram became the father of Amminadab. And Amminadab became the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon became the father of Selma. And Selma became the father of Boaz, and Boaz became the father of Obed, and Obed became the father of Jesse, and Jesse became the father of David. This is the word of our Lord. Friends, isn't it true that life can often feel like a gamble? Life can often feel like a gamble because even though we are careful to do our planning and our preparation, we are keenly aware of the fact that we have little to no control over the outcomes. No matter how diligent you are, you really have little control over the results of your actions. And so life can often feel like a gamble. We aren't the first ones to feel this way. In fact, the idea has been within the minds of men for as long as what history records. It's represented even in the idea of the Roman goddess Fortuna. Now, Fortuna is not that wonderful 4x4 that Toyota produces. Rather, it is the goddess of fate. See, Fortuna symbolized a cruel nature to luck. In a world that was dominated by chaos, in a world that had no one bringing order to it, the Romans believed that there was one goddess who influenced luck or random chance, but often Fortuna was a cruel goddess. And so she was depicted by the symbol of either a wheel or a balance. And the wheel would often turn, and the balance would tip. And that would indicate that no matter how much you pursued prosperity, she would flip it on you and bring about your ruin as quickly as what one would turn a wheel. Now, the ancient Romans would therefore invoke her in daily life because they recognized that no amount of preparation on their part could tame her rather fickle will. For example, the Roman Emperor Augustus attributed the premature deaths of his grandsons to Atrox Fortuna, that is, cruel fortune. Highlighted for him the fact that even though he had spent decades planning and preparing for the imperial succession to his grandsons, cruel fortune had the last word. He had no control over the outcome. Life, to him, as to us, feels like a gamble. He says, not only the pagans who feel this way, even the people of God have long recognized that while we are responsible to act, we cannot always control the outcome or the results of those actions. Solomon understood this keenly. He wrote in Ecclesiastes 9, verses 10 and 11, he said, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might." In other words, he understood the imperative to act. He understood our responsibility to take action. Do it with all your might, for there is no working or explaining or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. But after immediately noting that we must act, he follows on by saying, "I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the mighty. And neither is bread to the wise, nor riches to the discerning, nor favor to men who know. For time and misfortune overtake of them all." In fact, he represented the same idea in the simple proverb, Proverbs 21:31, when he said, "The horse is set for the day of battle." There's planning, there's preparation, there's human action and responsibility. But salvation, he says, belongs to Yahweh. In other words, the outcome of the battle belongs to God and not to man. Even within daily life, Solomon recognized this principle. He said in Proverbs 16:33, "The lot," in other words, the roll of the dice, as we would say today, "is cast into the lap, and its every judgment is from Yahweh." God is sovereign over even the lot, the roll of the dice. But there's a wonderful story, a brief account that illustrates what this is like for us on a daily basis. Turn briefly to 1 Chronicles 19. In 1 Chronicles 19, we find an illustration of how the people of God recognized the random outcome of their actions. They had no control. So if it wasn't in their control, whose control would it be? In the heat of battle, we find in 1 Chronicles 19, verses 10 to 13, that Joab, the commander of Israel's armies, faced a rather perilous situation. The armies of Israel were in trouble, as we see in verse 10. Then Joab saw that the battle was set against him in the front and in the rear. In other words, he was surrounded, a position that no general wants to find himself in. So he chose from all the choice men of Israel, and they arranged themselves to meet the Arameans. But the remainder of the people he put in the hand of Abishai, his brother, and they arranged themselves to meet the sons of Ammon. Two enemies, now we have two armies of Israel, divided in half to meet each foe. But notice what we see in verse 12. He says, and here's human action, "If the Arameans are too strong for me, then you shall save me. But if the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will save you." But verse 13 is key to illustrate our point. He says, "Be strong." In other words, act. "And let us show strength for the sake of our people." There's diligence. "And for the cities of our God." But notice that the outcome was not theirs. The results do not belong to the generals, nor to their armies, but to Yahweh, as Joab says, "And may Yahweh do what is good in his sight." In other words, they understood that the outcome was not theirs. The outcome belonged to God. And that's exactly the lesson that we'll see in Ruth chapter 4 today. We're reminded that while God holds us responsible to act, he remains the one in control of the outcomes. While God wants us to do what is right, the results belong squarely to him and his sovereign care. Now, at this point, I want to briefly remind you of the lessons that we've been learning through this narrative of Ruth. In chapter 1, we recognize that God is sovereign. But there was a key lesson for us, as the narrator wanted us to see that God is sovereign not only over what is good, but equally over what is evil. In other words, God is the God of both prosperity and calamity. And God's sovereignty through both is what he uses to work out his covenant love for his people. And so the lesson for us in chapter 1, as we see Naomi's calamity, is just realizing that both good and evil are part of God's plan and are therefore governed by God's sovereign power. But that set us up for chapter 2. If you remember, when we combine the ideas of God's sovereignty and his covenant love, we get that wonderful doctrine of providence. God is sovereign over our lives. He works out his plans and his purposes. His providence is comprehensive, covering every detail of our lives. And so for us, the lesson then was to recognize God's providence and rest in it. We can rest in the fact that God is working sovereignly to care for us. But that set up for us chapter 3. In chapter 3, we saw that God's providence should never lead to our inaction. Just because God is sovereign doesn't mean that we're not responsible to act. So we must respond to God's providence, but we do so by focusing on what is right, being careful to do what pleases God in any and every circumstance. That sets up for us what we find here in chapter 4. While God does hold us responsible to act, while God's sovereignty should produce diligent human action, the results remain with God. We're not responsible to produce them because we have no power over them. And so while we work, while we act, while we are responsible, we leave the outcomes to God. And this is a necessary corrective for our hearts, because we naturally, even pridefully, want to be in control. You see, isn't that what upsets us so much about the randomness of life, apparently? The fact that life seems like nothing more than a gamble, we've got no control over the outcomes. It's the fact that we really want to be in control. And we would love to be our own sovereign. We would love to have the power over all the details of our lives. While we are diligent to act, we're quickly confronted, though, by the reality that even when we do what is right, the results are not always what we intended, not always what we wanted. That's because we do have the responsibility to do what is right, but no control over the outcome. Now, this uncertainty that we're recognizing should not stop us from acting, should not stop us from doing what is right. And that's because, as we'll learn today and have reinforced in our minds and our hearts through Ruth chapter 4, you may be uncertain about the outcome of your actions, but you can always be certain of the God who sovereignly controls them. You may not have any control over your results, but that's okay because you know the one who is. God is in control. And because Yahweh is sovereign and His providence governs all the results of our actions, life is actually not a gamble. There isn't any randomness in the outcomes of our actions. Even when we're uncertain, God remains in complete control. And so as we look again in Ruth chapter 4, which is to say the fourth act in this wonderful play, the fourth act, we see God holds us responsible to do what is right, but He remains sovereign over the results in both the small and the big details of life. We'll see that as God brings resolution now to the story. God brings resolution to this wonderful demonstration in the lives of Naomi and Ruth. On the micro level, God brings resolution to the family and their drama. And on the macro level, God fulfills or sets up the fulfillment of a messianic prophecy. We'll see that He puts in place a line that will establish not only His care for the family of Elimelech, but even for the nation of Israel as He sets up the fulfillment of that messianic prophecy in the book of Micah. Now with that, let's look at the three sections that this fourth chapter or this fourth act breaks up into. The first is the resolution in the gate, as we find in the first 12 verses. And then we move on from the resolution in the gate to the rejoicing in the home. And finally, we'll end off with the royals in the line. But let's look firstly at the resolution in the gate from verses 1 to 12. It's important for us to note, as we look at verse 1, that there's no break in the chronology over here. There's no break in the timeline. If you remember, chapter 3 or Act 3 closed off with Boaz promising he would be diligent to fulfill what Ruth had proposed. And so while she is running home to go and tell Naomi of all that God is working out, Boaz is on his way to fulfill his undertaking. And that's what we see in verse 1. Boaz goes up to the gate. It's simultaneous action. There's no break in time over here. Now, going up represents something of the geography of a typical Israelite town. The town would have been perched on top of the hill, and so you go down to the fields and you go up to the town. Well, that makes sense. But more than just the geography over here, we can see the set determination to act. Boaz is going to do what is right. He's determined to act. And so he goes immediately up to the gate. Now, we need to understand that town gates in this era were complex structures. It's not like for us. It's not a simple trellis door, right? It's not a gate that we have in front of our driveway. It doesn't just roll to the side. It was part of the city's fortifications, and as such, it was a complex structure that included lookout towers on the outside, and even a series of rooms within where defenders could be stationed. And so the town gate or the city gate could hold anything from 100 men up to a number of 100 men stationed there in something of a barracks. It became then naturally a place where city business was conducted. It immediately became the heart of the town. This is where official business would be dealt with. So that's why Boaz goes immediately to the gates. And you can see he's not there to chit-chat. He's not there to socialize. He sits down. In other words, he takes an official seat and everyone knows immediately this man means business. Now the narrator once again uses wonderful wordplays to remind us of themes that have already been established. Because as Boaz goes up to the gate and sits down, the narrator says, "Behold." or look reminds us of when earlier he spoke of the sheer luck, the chance by which Boaz arrived in the field at exactly the same time that Ruth was there. Now we know, of course, that there is no sheer luck, only God's sovereignty. But once again, we're being drawn to that detail. It wasn't by random chance, it wasn't by sheer luck, it was by God's sovereignty, his providence at work, that just as Boaz sits down, the very man he needs to meet with happens to be coming through the same gates. This is a kinsman redeemer of whom Boaz spoke, as the narrator tells us. And as he was passing by, Boaz calls out to him. He says, "Turn aside, my fellow." In other words, hold on, I need to have a word with you. Now, the phrase here, "my fellow," has got to be one of my favorite details in the entire book. We don't really grasp what the Hebrew is doing over here. It really doesn't name the character. It means something along the lines of Mr. So-and-so, or perhaps even what's your name, right? Obviously, Boaz knew the name, but we'll see in a moment why the narrator is deliberately hiding it. In fact, if we transliterate the Hebrew into English directly, we have Poloni Elmoni, right? What a ridiculous name. Mr. So-and-so, Mr. What's-your-face. But the narrator does that on purpose because Poloni Elmoni has no name. And we'll see how that is contrasted with Boaz, whose name is preserved for all of time. Because Poloni Elmoni is nothing more than a contrast to Boaz and his covenant love and righteousness. Though this man was indeed the first redeemer, we'll come to see that he doesn't have the same character that Boaz did. And so, Boaz calls out, "Sit down here, Poloni Elmoni." And he turned aside and sat down. And immediately we can see something of Boaz's status. If you remember in chapter 2, he was described as a man of excellence, which meant primarily his character. But he certainly did have significant social standing to be able to waylay a man from his business. And so he says, "Sit down." And then in verse 2, he calls on the men, the elders of the city. This man is significant within their social scheme. For Boaz to pull aside not only a family member, but now 10 of the elders, 10 of the most important men in the city, and they listen to him, speaks to just how much standing he had in the town of Bethlehem. Now, the number 10 is important because 10 men were required to constitute a legal proceeding. 10 was the minimum number of Jewish men that you needed for a synagogue, by the way. But 10 is the minimum number of elders that you need for a formal court proceeding, so to speak. Because that's exactly what's going on over here. Boaz is about to initiate legal proceedings. And so he wants all of the formalities taken care of. The men sit down, and so the court case unfolds, as we see in verse 3. He says to the kinsman redeemer, to Mr. Poloni Elmoni, he draws his attention to the fact that Naomi, who has come back from the fields of Moab, has to sell the portion of the field which belonged to our brother Elimelech. Now notice immediately that Boaz makes the issue about Naomi. He draws the attention to her need. We've noticed previously how both Boaz and Ruth have got a selfless motivation in how they act. Boaz isn't just here for selfish interest trying to secure the hand of Ruth, but really wants to care for Naomi and for the family of Elimelech. The crisis that he draws Poloni's attention to is the fact that the land needs to be sold. Now, we need to understand the historical context of what was going on over here. Elimelech evidently did not transfer the land permanently to another owner, but instead would have entrusted it to another one's care. Essentially, someone would have rented out the fields. They would have had the rights and privileges of then using it. When Naomi and Ruth returned, they returned in the middle of harvest season. It would have been impossible for Naomi to reclaim the land, because the one who was using it had the right to harvest the crops that were on the land. And so the first time that she could legally access the land was after the harvest. We know that both barley and wheat harvests have been concluded by this point, and so for the first time she has the opportunity to act. But because she's destitute, because she's in financial crisis, the need is pressing on her to sell the land. And this is unthinkable in the theology of land that the nation of Israel held to. By the mere fact that it needed to be redeemed, it tells you that Naomi was considering selling the land to someone outside of the clan. As the Israelites understood their theology of the land, they recognized that God was the owner. God owned the land. It was his, but he had given it or gifted it to families within the context of tribes or clans. And God had put into place instructions within the Torah, within the law, to ensure that the land never left the clan, never left the tribe. Because the welfare of the people is tied directly to the land. And so in a situation where there was financial crisis and a family member needed to sell the land, now we have the legal requirement for family members to act as redeemers. We've noted all along that redeemers, by instruction of the Torah, are there to redeem land. They're there to redeem property, not people. And that's exactly what Boaz highlights now for Polony Almoni. The land is in crisis because Naomi's about to sell it. It's about to leave the clan. You need to act. And so verse 4 comes along and he says, I thought to uncover it. How generous does he sound right now? I thought to bring it to your attention and your hearing and say, acquire it. In other words, act. Do what is right. Redeem the land. And do it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, then redeem it. But if no one redeems it, tell me that I may know. For there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. In other words, he's highlighting the order of succession. There is a redeemer. It's not Boaz, it's Polony Almoni. He has the first responsibility to act. But as he's responsible to act, Boaz also indicates rather subtly, but nevertheless clearly, that he has an interest in the land too. And if Polony will not act, if what's-his-face will not do what is right, Boaz stands ready to do what is necessary. In verse 5, though, he says, it's not just as simple as that. He draws his attention to the land, and immediately Polony says, well, that sounds like a great deal to me. Who wouldn't want a great deal to expand their property portfolio? It meant adding to his land, it meant increasing his wealth. And so in verse 4, he says, I'll do it, I will acquire it. But in verse 5, we see one of the keys to this final act in the narrative. Because Boaz says, on the day that you acquire the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess. Now here there's a key interpretive issue. Here we need to understand what's going on, and it comes down to how the Hebrew language was first written down. You see, the Hebrew language was first written down without vowels. It had only consonants. And when you were familiar with the text, that was fine. You've seen how we do that in English. If you write a sentence and remove all the vowels, our brains remarkably are still able to understand what's written. That's the same in Hebrew. But as time passed, the Jews recognized that it was becoming harder and harder for successive generations to know precisely what was being written. Especially because some words can be spelt the same way, and the only thing that determines one meaning from another are the vowel points. And so a group of Israelites named the Masoretes introduced what is called the vowel points. There are often dots and dashes that are added to the Hebrew consonants. Now, they are not inspired. They were added to the text many hundreds of years later. It's the consonants that are there by divine inspiration. And most often, we understand that the Masoretes were able to read and therefore give us clarity in terms of what is written. But every now and then, they disagreed with what was written down in the texts. We have what is written and then what is understood. In Hebrew, we call it the Ketiv and the Kere readings of the Hebrew text. In the Ketiv, the way that it is written, the way that it is originally inspired, this is not what's translated in our text. In that original reading, it actually doesn't say you must acquire. Boaz rather boldly says, I will acquire. The Masoretes, though, thought that didn't make much sense, and so they changed the vowel points to indicate that it was you, the Poloni Almoni Redeemer. But there's no need for us to follow the Masoretes' interpretation, because the original consonants actually make a lot of sense. In fact, I think they make the most sense out of what's going on over here. Because as you see, Boaz introduces the detail of Ruth, and then immediately that changes how Poloni Almoni views the matter. Immediately he pulls out of the prospect. And there are two probable reasons for that. Working from least significant to most, we see that firstly, Boaz highlights the fact that this is Ruth the Moabitess. As much as what Boaz has come to respect her character, she's a woman of excellence, and even the women of the city have come to recognize it too. Nevertheless, Boaz rather slyly reminds Poloni Almoni that this woman is not an Israelite. Remember what's his face. This woman is an outsider. And she's a Moabitess. And we can immediately see that his interest cools. He thought he was just getting a great deal on land, but now he has to marry a Moabite woman. Well, that doesn't sound great. But there's something that I think is even more significant, and that's the fact that Boaz doesn't actually tell the Redeemer to marry her. He says, I'm going to marry her. If we follow the original lettering, he's telling him, I'm going to marry Ruth. Regardless of what you do with the land, I've set it in my heart to marry her. And that actually makes a lot of sense given his determination in chapter 3 already. But why does that present a complication for Poloni Almoni? That's because he understood the law of levirate marriage. He understood what Boaz intended to do. By marrying Ruth, as he says in verse 5, he intends to raise up an heir to legally inherit Mahlon's estate. Which means that if Poloni Almoni redeems the land from Naomi's hand, there's a ticking time bomb on that prospect. It may prove lucrative, but not for long. Because if Boaz and Ruth produce an heir, that heir has the legal right to inherit the land. And that's the complication that Poloni Almoni points to. That's what changes, that's what tips the scales and changes the balance so that he's no longer interested in marrying, sorry, he's no longer interested in acquiring the land, because it would mean that by Boaz marrying Ruth, he would only have the land for a short period of time. And so that's the complication and how it's overcome. If you remember in chapter 3, there was a complication as Boaz points Ruth to the fact that this man existed. But notice how wisely and how carefully Boaz acted. He said, listen, you're going to have to do what is right, but it's not for your sake. And here's the key differentiation between Poloni Almoni and why he dies a nameless, faceless, anonymous character, whereas Boaz's name and reputation is preserved forever. Because we can see the selfishness in Poloni Almoni. He really only cared about enlarging his own land. We even see in verse 6, the kinsman redeemer, Mr. What's-His-Face, says, I cannot redeem it. But it doesn't end there. The narrator's careful to include the words, for myself. He's the only one that he is considering. He's the only one that he's thinking about. Lest I ruin my own inheritance. Now contrast that with the selfless covenant love of Boaz in verse 5. Not only does he declare his willingness to marry Ruth, but he explains his motivations. He says she is the widow of the one who had died, and he wants to marry her in order to raise up the name of the one who had died. Now, this is part of the levirate provision within the Torah. In Deuteronomy 25, verse 7, we understand within Moses' instruction on that, the importance of raising up a name. If one would refuse, then Moses says, but if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, Then his brother's wife shall go up to the gates, again, the place of legal proceeding, to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name for his brother in Israel. He's not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. You see, that represents the real concern in the Torah provision of a levirate marriage. It was about the name of the deceased. It was about the fact that he would always be remembered through his children and his children's children, or conversely be forgotten if he loses a line. In ancient Israel, the most fearful curse was, may your seed perish and may your name die out. That was the worst imaginable scenario for an Israelite man. And that's exactly where Mahlon, now dead, found himself. His seed was cut off and his name was about to be forgotten. But Boaz acts like a levirate. But in Deuteronomy 25, Moses is clear that it's only a blood brother who is responsible to act as a levirate. There's actually no legal obligation on Boaz to do this. He could have married Ruth and had a child with her and would have been his own child and had nothing to do with Mahlon. But Boaz was never driven by the letter of the law. We saw that in how he took care of Ruth in the fields. He went over and above what was required by the law of Moses. Here again, he's not acting out of legal obligation, but out of moral obligation. He's demonstrating chesed. He's demonstrating covenant love by doing what is right, understanding the principle or the spirit of the Torah over and above the simple legalistic letter. And so he understands that here's an opportunity to serve the family. He wants to marry Ruth, doubtless because she's young and attractive and he'd love a companion, but he's very clear that he also wants to serve the family of Elimelech and her dead husband, Mahlon. And so in contrast to the selfishness of Polonia Almoni, here we see wonderful covenant love on the part of Boaz. And so even though we see Polonia Almoni pull out, we see Boaz come now with a resolution to the crisis in the city gate. Now, as we think about the application of this, we need to recognize that Boaz was not taking a gamble when he brought this matter to the court. It may seem that way because as we're reading through the narrative, we tense up, wondering what on earth Boaz is doing. Why are you presenting this opportunity to Polonia Almoni? What if he makes a decision that produces a different result? But Boaz knew that this was the right way, this was the honorable way to act. And there was no chance in the outcome, there was no risk, because as Boaz understood it, God was sovereignly caring for him and for Ruth, and even by extension, Naomi. It's precisely because Boaz would recognize and rest in God's providence that he was able to do what is right and then trust the results, not to his own clever engineering, not to the roll of the dice in a risky gamble, but to the outcome of Yahweh's sovereign care. And so Boaz wasn't taking a gamble. He was confident in God's sovereign care, so confident that he not only trusted the outcome of this court case to God's hands, but even put it in the hands of another. As much as what we may recognize that our hands are limited in power to produce the results that we want, the only thing that we fear more than the little control we can exercise is putting the matter in someone else's control. Isn't that true? Leaving the matter in someone else's hands, and that's exactly what Boaz did. He wasn't gambling. Now, this matter is concluded, as we see in verse 7, from a legal point of view, with a custom. A shoe is exchanged. That sounds weird, doesn't it? If you're not a fan of feet or you're not a fan of shoes, this probably grosses you out. But we need to understand the deep identification of the people with the land. We even see this in the New Testament, in Matthew 10, when Jesus tells his disciples that when there is a city that rejects their gospel preaching, they need to go out of the city and brush the dust off their feet. Because for the Israelites, the dust represented their deep identification with the land, with the city. And so that's what's happening here. For the landowner, his sandals and the dust that clung to them represented his deep identification with the land he owned. And so by giving that sandal to another, he was symbolically transferring the identification that he held to another man. So they would now, in a wonderful way, become another man's property. Now the narrator has to explain that because doubtless this was written a number of years after the fact. But we see in verse 8 that the kinsman redeemer then says, well, Boaz, you acquire it. And he formalizes it by giving him his sandal. It's basically him signing the contract, signing over the deed to Boaz. And so Boaz calls on everyone to witness. And here again, he points to his noble motives. I've acquired everything that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon from the hand of Naomi. In other words, I'm doing this for the family. And in verse 10, I'm doing this also for this destitute widow, Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon. Again, he emphasizes the idea of raising up a name, making sure that Mahlon and by extension Elimelech's family was not cut off. They would have a seed. They would have a name. And so everyone blesses him as they affirm what they have witnessed. But that blessing is particularly instructive for us, as they say in verse 11. May Yahweh grant the woman who is coming into your home to be like Rachel and Leah. Now that's a fascinating comparison. Because if you read the account of Rachel and Leah, you'll know that neither woman was particularly upstanding in their character. In fact, the two sisters used to fight and squabble. And so it's not their character that's highlighted, but their role in the nation of Israel. They built up the nation of Israel. They built up the house. Their children became so significant that they were mother figures in the nation. But also, highlighting Rachel over Leah, remembering that Leah was actually the direct ancestor of those who lived here in Bethlehem, by highlighting Rachel, they're actually identifying with her struggles with infertility. And so just as God overcame Rachel's infertility, they're praying also that Ruth's infertility, or apparent infertility, would be overcome as she marries Boaz. And as she produces offspring, according to their prayer, they're asking that God would thereby reward Boaz for his noble action by achieving excellence in Ephrathah and having his name proclaimed in Bethlehem. Notice that even though he acted for another man's name, now the people pray that he will be rewarded for such excellent covenant love by having his own name built up, by having his own excellence proclaimed. He acted honorably and they pray that he will be rewarded. And they don't stop there. They add to it by saying, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Once again, not a particularly honorable situation, since Tamar bore Perez by virtue of incestuous prostitution. Nevertheless, it's the identification with the levirate marriage. So once again, they're recognizing the parallels. There's a levirate situation. They're praying that just as Perez came to hold significance in the nation of Israel, that the child born to Ruth and to Boaz would have the same kind of prominence. What's interesting to note, though, is that the people of the town recognize God as sovereign. They understood what we need to understand. Though Boaz and Ruth were going to act by getting married, God remained sovereign over the womb. God is the one who would control whether they had a son. That's why they're praying that God would grant it. Not just that God would not interfere, but that God would actively work to produce it. Now, friends, again, as we think about the application here, we need to remember that sometimes big decisions, especially decisions like marriage, can feel like a gamble, right? Because what we're often drawn to are the outcomes, the results. What will this decision produce? In fact, if we're honest, we most often try to make decisions based on what we can foresee or predict to be the outcome. We focus less on what is right and more on what will produce our desired results. You see, we try to control the results. And if we're honest, we're actually a lot more like Naomi in her pragmatism than we are like Ruth and Boaz in resting in God's providence. But when we rest, we will then understand that no decision we make and no action that we take is ever a gamble. God is in control. And instead of allowing our lack of control to breed fear in our hearts and paralyze our actions, we need to respond in faith, recognizing God's sovereignty and thereby being freed up to act according to what pleases Him. Now this produces then, as we come to the next section in the narrative, rejoicing in the home. Resolution in the gate moves on to rejoicing in the home as the prayers of the people are fulfilled in verses 13 to 17. The narrator says that Boaz took Ruth, and that's merely alluding to the fact that men dominated society. This was a male-led society. And so even though Ruth was the one who propositioned Boaz, he was the one who was taking the authoritative legal step to marry her. She became his wife. A wonderful transformation of her standing. She came into the town, into the city as an outsider, and then progressed on to become something of the handmaid or the servant of Boaz, a slight social elevation. But now Yahweh's goodness and loving kindness to her has elevated her to the point of being the wife of such a noble and excellent man. The account says that he went into her, and we should probably note that that's not a euphemism. It's not trying to portray any kind of intimacy over there. Really, it's describing the way that a husband would enter the bridal tent of his wife in order to produce offspring. And so Yahweh granted her conception. They acted, and Yahweh produced the results so that she gave birth to a son. Now, as people see that their prayers have been fulfilled, the woman take a turn. It was the men who had blessed Boaz, but now the woman come to bless Naomi. They say, blessed is Yahweh, who has not left you without a kinsman redeemer today. May his name be proclaimed in Israel. It's interesting to note, first off, that it's not Naomi who recognizes this. Naomi has consistently been a problematic character for us in this story. She has been a deeply compromised Israelite. Even now, at this wonderful resolution point where God fulfills his covenant love to her, she doesn't immediately recognize it. She needs others to point it out to her. But the woman of the city, the woman of the town, notice this, and they point to Yahweh in praise. We should also note, though, that the kinsman redeemer they have in mind is actually not Boaz. It's Obed, the son that we will be introduced to shortly. They tell Naomi that their prayer is now that Obed would have his name proclaimed. He would become prominent within the nation of Israel. And that towards Naomi, in verse 15, he would restore her soul and sustain her even into her old age, or more literally, even into her gray hairs. They recognize that God was filling up the one who had come back empty. Wasn't that Naomi's complaint? I went out full, I came back empty. And now, perhaps without her even noticing, Yahweh has filled her back up again. Yahweh has restored her. Yahweh has lavished his loving kindness on her. He's given her his loyal love in two forms. The first one that's pointed out to us here is Obed. Obed will be the one, not Boaz and not Ruth, to provide financial security to Naomi until the day that she dies. As he inherits the land, he'll be the one to take care of his grandmother. But beyond that, we also read that God has filled up Naomi in the form of Ruth, because she's a wonderful daughter-in-law. She is the daughter-in-law par excellence. She loves you, they point out. And the Hebrew word for love is really not an emotion. The Hebrew word ahav expresses covenant commitment. It expresses action in the interest of the other person. In other words, this is the same kind of covenant love. It's not chesed, but it's the same idea. She loves you, and she demonstrates that in her actions towards you. In fact, she's so good that she's better for you than seven sons. Now, that superlative praise is actually culturally significant, because in the book of Job, we recognize what is for the Israelites an ideal family. If you were to ask a young aspiring bachelor what he would like when he gets married, how many kids would you like to have? The expected answer was 10. Sorry, ladies, that's a lot. 10, seven sons and three daughters, which is coincidentally exactly what Job had, the ideal family. And so what the ladies of the town of Bethlehem are pointing out to Naomi is that even if you had the perfect family with seven sons, Ruth is better than that. How much is that in terms of praise? How significant is that in how much they are honoring her? Now, this rejoicing then in the home, because we've now moved away from the city gate into the home of Boaz and Ruth, comes to this wonderful point in verse 16, where the child has been born, but it fills up Naomi's heart as she takes the child and puts him on her bosom and becomes his nurse. And the term is distinct from the term that would have been used for a wet nurse, and so she's not nursing the child in that sense. Really, she's caring for him. She's becoming his nanny. And since they would have lived in the same compound, that makes perfect sense. Don't grandmothers just love grandsons, right? We've got many ladies here who will attest to that. And so when she came back to Bethlehem, Naomi could scarcely imagine the joy that is now filling up her heart. She has this son, Obed, in her bosom. It's the place where something that is treasured is kept. She loves this child, and Yahweh has filled her up by means of this joy. And the neighbor woman then come in verse 17 and say, a son has been born to Naomi. Now, obviously, they're not meaning that literally. They're recognizing the significance of how God has controlled the outcomes. And so his name is called Obed, which means the one who serves. He serves as the agent of Yahweh's covenant love. He's going to be the one to fill up Naomi, to bring her security and to bring her joy. And once again, as we think of applying this, perhaps there's no greater area in life where we recognize that our actions have zero control over the results than when we act to procreate. A husband and a wife can do what they do, but God is the one who grants conception, isn't he? And so from the greater to the lesser, if God teaches us to do what is right and to trust him with the results in this area, then in every other smaller area we should too. Because when we're freed from fear, when we're no longer controlled by the desire to control, so that it produces fear and anxiety in our hearts, then we're freed up to do what is the most worshipful thing we can do: live with contentment and thank God for what we have. We may not control the outcomes, but God does. And since God is good and does good, we should be able to thank him for whatever the outcomes are, which is precisely what the woman of the city did. It's precisely what Boaz and Ruth would have done, and we hope, giving her the benefit of the doubt, that Naomi eventually was able to do too. But you know who else was able to do that? You know who else was able to act with worshipful contentment? Because though he did what was right, he trusted God with the results? Job. In Job 1, we know the story. Verses 20, Job arose after the devastating news. He had done what was right. He had acted to protect his children both physically and spiritually, and yet he lost his family along with his possessions, and Job tore his robe, then shaved his head and fell to the ground. And don't overlook that he worshiped. He worshiped God as he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. Yahweh gave and Yahweh has taken away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh." You see, regardless of what the outcomes are, whether they are our preferred outcomes or not, whether we recognize them as good or evil, well, we should be able to worship God like this. That's what it means to leave the results with Him. MacArthur has said that contentment is the highest form of worship, because that's when we truly recognize God for who He is and how, how He is sovereignly ordering our lives. And we can see that here in the rejoicing in the home of Boaz and Ruth. But the account ends finally in one final, we can scarcely call it a scene, but an addendum that's added to the end of the narrative. The third section, royals in the line, as we see this genealogy. To note, first of all, the genealogy summarizes more than 800 years. We don't recognize that. It's somewhat telescoped in. The Jews, for the purpose of memorization, would often skip generations. If you were paying attention, you would notice that between Perez and David, there were more than 800 years of history. Clearly, then, there are more than 10 generations here, but the generations are arranged in order to aid memorization. The point isn't so much to give us a line of every single child that was born, but to link Perez with David. The point is to highlight David. The point is to highlight that through Boaz was born Obed, and therefore was born Jesse, and therefore was born David. You see, this isn't so much concerned with the legal status. Because remember, in a Levirate marriage, the legal status of Obed would have been Mahlon's son. Now, this is not a list of legal inheritance. This rather is a list of begetters. Blood wins out over law in this case, as the narrator highlights the link to the fulfillment of that messianic prophecy that we first encountered when we studied chapter 1. To remind you, though, you can turn briefly, if you'd like, to Micah chapter 5. The constant reminder of God working in the background to fulfill not only His covenant love to the family of Naomi and Elimelech, but even to the nation of Israel is there throughout the narrative when the narrator uses the term Bethlehem Ephrathah. The only other link that we have then, other than to David, is what we find here in Micah chapter 5. And this prophecy that you'll recognize when in verse 2, we read, "As for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. His going forths are from everlasting, from ancient of days. Therefore he will give them up until the time when she who is in childbirth has born a child. Then the remainder of his brothers will return to the sons of Israel. And he will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of Yahweh, in the majesty of the name of Yahweh as God, and they will remain, because at that time he will be great to the ends of the earth, and this one will be peace." That's the Messiah. And God has now resolved the crisis not only in the family of Elimelech for Naomi, but in the family of Elimelech for the line that would eventually produce the greatest of David's heirs, Jesus Christ, the Messiah. And so God is at work in the results. God is at work in the outcomes, not only on the small scale, but on the large scale. Not only in the picture of day-to-day life, but in the grand scheme of redemption. Not only at the micro level, as He cares for Naomi and Ruth and Boaz, but at the macro level, as He cares for the nation of Israel, and by extension, for you and I too. God fulfills this messianic prophecy. Boaz acted. Boaz did what was right. But not only did he not have control over this particular messianic outcome, he could scarcely even conceive of its existence. And so God is always doing far more than we can ever imagine. But friends, once again, as we apply this, God is sovereign over both big and small. God is sovereign over the big decisions and the big events in world history. But God's also sovereign over what happens in our lives on a daily basis. And so whether our hearts are concerned about the seeming gamble in our decisions, in our actions, on the big scale or on the small scale, This final chapter, this final act in the story of Ruth tells us that we need to focus on doing what is right and leaving the results with God. God does hold us responsible to act. We've seen that. But as we recognize and rest in his providence, we leave the results, both small and big, with him. Because life is not a gamble. You're not in control, but that's okay. Because God is in control. And so we close with a hymn, a wonderful hymn that we've previously cited in this series. What God ordains is always good. In the second verse, the hymn says, "What God ordains is always good. He never will deceive me. He leads me in the righteous way, and never will he leave me. I take content what he has sent. His hand that sends me sadness will turn my tears to gladness." You know, Naomi could have written that. Ruth could have written that. And I trust you will learn to write that for yourself. As you do what is right, recognizing that God is in control and therefore leaving the results with him, but responding then with contentment in whatever those results may be. Yahweh is good, and Yahweh does good. Let's pray. Father in heaven, you are good. You do good. And implicit in that expression of our faith is the acknowledgement that you are in control. But how often our hearts wrestle to take that control away from you so that we can control our outcomes ourselves. And yet that's not what you've given us to do. Thank you for the reminder that you hold us accountable to do what is right, to focus on obeying and pleasing you, and then resting, leaving the results to you. Fill our hearts, therefore, not with a desire to control our outcomes, but with the worshipful attitude of contentment in whatever outcomes you bring us. Because as we've been reminded today, you are good and you do good. On the big picture and on the small picture, we praise you for every result that you've brought into our lives, whether bitter or sweet, because we know that you are doing far more than we can ask or imagine. For your glory and for our good, as you demonstrate to us the same covenant love that we first received in Christ. It's in his name that we pray. Amen.